Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Three Questions. I'm your host, Andy Richter. Today, I'm talking to Moshe Kasher. Moshe is a very funny stand-up comedian, an actor, and a writer. Moshe's new book, Subculture Vulture, A Memoir in Six Scenes, is out now. Moshe will also be bringing his live book tour across the country. You can find dates on linktree.com/Moshe Kasher. Moshe joined me live in the studio, and we had a really fantastic conversation. He's had some crazy stuff go on in his life. And here is my great conversation with Moshe Kasher.
Can't you tell my love?
Hi, everyone. I'm here in studio today, which is always a lovely thing.
Oh, it's better than Zoom.
Oh, it certainly is.
I have full-blown COVID, though, so there might be a back end that you don't enjoy.
Listen, I actually just vaccinated myself twice yesterday.
Oh, you self-vaxxed?
Mm-hmm. I fell off a truck, let's just say. COVID-wise, I do feel like I have been vaccinated enough because I have had a couple instances where I was in the proximity of somebody that then came down with, you know, then later tested positive. And I'm not saying like I'm bulletproof and I don't think that, but I do kind of feel like, nah, I think I'm okay.
Forever.
Well, I mean, no, I think I'm always going to be getting... I will always get a flu shot, and I will always get, I love vaccines.
I love
yum,
them.
Yum, yum.
No, I love them just, too.
I can't get enough.
I do gummies. I don't know if you guys, they do gummy vaccines now. The Novavax gummies, they're actually very tasty.
Mm.
And they have CBD in them, so it kind of takes the edge off the stress of life.
Yeah, the vax vapes.
Honestly, if we could put the vaccine into a vape juice, I do think we could get more people on board.
You know what? You're probably right. Or if you just dip cigarettes in them, I bet there'd be people who'd be like, well, all right.
I'm sensing right now a branding opportunity for Team Coco, okay? And I don't know if you want to put this up the flagboard or just put it into production directly, but I think Team Coco Vax Vapes is not a terrible idea.
Yep. And if there's anything that makes you think Conan O'Brien, it's vapes.
It's vaccinated vapes. In partnership with Pfizer.
Well, I'm here with Moshe Kasher. You know that already because I just probably did an intro to him.
And heard those crazy vax vapes riffs, so you know you're in comedically good hands.
You know that it's funny town. And he's here promoting his book, which you have a copy of.
Well, I don't know. When I was leaving, I thought it would be a good thing to hold up. I don't know. Is that a thing? It feels like a thing people do.
Well, yeah.
You make a point and you go, as it says
this
in my book.
This might end up on Instagram. You never know.
As it says in my book. Which is conveniently in my hands right now.
Subculture Vulture. Well, you should just get one. You should get a big pocket pouch.
It's
a hip holster that you can just pull it out and
that's a really good idea. When I go to coffee shops or whatever,
uh-huh.
And I go, I like to go through coffee shops in Hollywood and ask people what they're working on, you know? I just I go, is that a screenplay? And then I turn it around. I say, I'm with the William Morris Agency.
Yeah. My favorite thing about coffee shops in Hollywood, although it hasn't happened in a while, is when someone recognizes me and then they carpet bomb me with names that I don't know.
Oh, yeah?
You know, oh, it's always things like, oh, hey, Andy, listen. Yeah, hi, my name's Bob. And listen, I worked with James sure. McElroy. And I also talked to Shelley, Shelley, Mix-a-Lot or whatever. You know,
Shelley Mix-a-Lot is Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Sir Mix-a-Lot's daughter.
It's actually disrespectful to call her Shelley Mix-a-Lot because she also has a title. She's Lady Mix-a-Lot. He's Sir Mix-a-Lot. And when he got knighted, everybody in the family became royalty. Yeah. She's the Duchess of Mix-a-Lot.
She does not mix that much.
No.
She doesn't. Yeah. I mean, that was more her dad's thing.
Baby got title.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah,
sorry.
Right, right, right.
Anyway, I'm here promoting.
No, but that was always, the carpet bombing of names was always something that I would notice a bullshitter. And it was, you know, in the first few times I was like, where they'd say all these names, and I don't know who anyone is anyway. I still have things, like we were just talking a moment ago about auditioning, and like a part that I was just reading for that was kind of like a dramatic part. My agent said, she said something like, listen, Brian Miller is auditioning for this. And I was like, oh, not knowing who that was at all. And it wasn't Brian Miller. It was some other name, but I was like, and I even said like, who? And she said, Brian Miller.
Brian fucking Miller.
And I was like, oh, I don't know.
And what are you even supposed to do with that information? Even if you,
I think,
oh,
it's,
Brian Miller, I'll adjust the read then.
I think it's because she was sort of trying to impress. It's actually kind of funny. And I love her. She, Serafina, I love you. But it was the part of the leader of the white nationalists in prison. Like,
I read for that too.
Oh, you did?
They said I was woefully miscast.
Yeah,
I don't quite understand why.
They said too Jewy.
Yeah, a little too Jewy for the leader
for
the of
white
the Nazis.
Nationalists. Yeah. but she told me, when she told me about it, she goes like, and she said, don't be afraid to go dark.
Mm.
And I was like, you know what? I kind of think if I read the leader of the White Nationalist Party as lighthearted,
kind of wacky,
it might be kind of offensive.
Here are the rules of prison. The whites with the whites and the blacks with the blacks. And you ride off on a unicycle.
You know, I have to find something to love about every character.
Here's how prison works economically. We sell vape vax.
But anyway, yeah. So,
coffee shops in Hollywood. Oh, I was going to say, and it actually does tie into the book, because part of the book is how many different universes I've kind of lived
in.
Yeah.
And it is something like, you know, I have like a little sheet of research here on you, and it really is, it sounds like six different people.
Well, it kind of in a way is, but I don't know. They kind of synthesized into, I think that's what everybody's life is, right? Is these like, no, don't
yours
you think
it's a little bit like, a little bit more than most.
Let's get into it. But I was going to say that sometimes in Hollywood, I'll have this experience where I'm walking down the street, especially when I first moved here, and I would see someone, I would go, do I know that person from AA, from Burning Man, from the Bay Area? Are they a comedian, or is that Brad Pitt? Like, I don't know what I'm recognizing
here.
Yeah,
and see, not many people would get to do that, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Or do I know that person from Shul, you know?
It generally, a little too Jewy for Shul.
But it is true. And the book is called Subculture Vulture, and it's in six different scenes. And I guess it's like, it's six different parts of your life that, like you just listed, Burning Man, growing up with deaf parents, addiction into, you know, a mental facility.
Yeah.
Then stand up, you know.
Stand up and sign language interpreting and deafness. It's sort of like, you know, I wrote my first book. I came on the show a million years ago when the first book came out.
Right.
And it was the story.
Casher in the Rye.
Casher
right?
in the Rye, yeah. The true tale of a white boy from Oakland who became a drug addict, criminal, mental patient, and then turned 16.
Yes.
So that was sort of the first stanza of my. Everybody always says, like, how are you on your second memoir? I mean, how many things have you done? And like, the first stanza of my life was this pure chaos. And then I got sober when I was 15. I got out of rehab for the last time at 15.
Wow.
And went in for the first time when I was, I think, 13. So there was most of my time drinking was in and out of rehab.
Yeah.
And I thought my life was over. I really thought, like, when I got sober at 15, I was like, okay, I'm going to live, but I'm going to physically survive. But I'm done. Like, there's nothing else for me in life, because drugs and alcohol at that age were like the only thing that had ever made my life feel palatable, the only thing that ever made my life feel livable. And I thought, I'm okay, I'll live, but I will be bored. And when I wrote that book, it ends like basically the day I get sober. And everybody over the years, people would constantly ask me, like, what happened next? What happened next? And I very specifically didn't want to write a book that was like a recovery, like Tuesdays with Maury kind of book.
Yeah.
And I started to think about that in the last few years, like, what happened next? And the answer was, everything else, you know, a lot. And I occupied these six worlds that really became these universes that became the building blocks of my personhood and who I am. And they are, like you said, they're AA and drug rehab, Judaism and Hasidic Judaism. My father, when he and my mom split, my dad kind of got born again and remarried into an ultra, ultra, ultra Orthodox Hasidic Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And I spent my summer vacations in Brooklyn essentially cosplaying as a Hasidic Jew while being a secular Oakland Public School kids, the rest of the year.
Yeah, yeah. How did you pull off the payas?
I'm glad you asked, Andy. That was a real tell.
I'm always thinking about hair.
You're always thinking about payas.
Styling and payas.
You texted me, a concerning amount of time about payas and whether I was bringing them to the podcast today. And I didn't. But that was a big tell.
Yeah.
I had these tells in that neighborhood because what would literally happen is my father would pick me up at the airport. He would drive me directly from the airport to it's funny you mentioned hair because that was the first stop. The first stop was at the Hasidic Jewish barbershop at pretty much every time. We would stop there and this sort of, like Yiddish speaking barber would kind of look at my California bowl cut in disgust and think like, I assume like, what are we going to do with this? Try to approximate the closest he could to a secular. I mean, he was in on it, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
And I would like cut.
Well, yeah, he was in on your secret. Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah,
he knew that I was.
You're not a real Jew.
Not the real.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny you say not a real Jew because the kids in my neighborhood in Seagate, this was the neighborhood in Brooklyn. As I say in my stand up act, I say, if you don't know how to get to Seagate, now I'll explain. You take the F train to the last possible stop. You get off. You walk past Coney Island, past the projects, past the people of color, through a gate, through a time portal to pre-Nazi Europe, and you'll then arrive in Seagate.
Where everyone's wearing different fashioned hats made out of beaver or
something.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They're selling baubles and using horse-drawn buggies, spitting at redheads because they're bad luck. That was my summer vacation. So it's so funny because like my real Jew friends, my friends that have a fulsome Jewish experience, they had both a more and much more and much less Jewish experience than me because they had a year-round Jewish experience.
Right.
I would have nothing, and then 6 weeks a year, I would be an extra on the set of Yentl. That was the dynamic.
Yeah.
So this barber would cut my hair down to create kind of a silhouette,
right,
an illusion of side locks.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad would throw a velvet yarmulke on me, slacks, a dress shirt, and he would take me to Seagate, where literally the kids in the neighborhood spoke Yiddish as a first language. These were accented children that were third-generation American. They had Eastern European accents. Their families didn't. This is the weirdest part, is my uncle Heshy, he sounds like a New Yorker.
Like uncle by marriage or your dad?
My step uncle.
Okay.
So my father's wife's brother.
Yeah.
He had an American accent because he was a first generation immigrant, first generation immigrant's kid.
Yeah.
And the first generation immigrant's kids, the parents go, fit in, you got to fit in.
Right.
Be an American.
Right.
So he sounded like an American. But by the time he got to adulthood and started having kids, he was feeling comfortable in his position as an American, and he would have these kids, my cousins, and they would be reared in Yiddish-speaking yeshivas.
Wow.
So he sounds like a Yankees fan. They sound like characters in Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole dynamic was weird. And I would walk into town with an English prayer book, which was a scarlet letter.
Wow.
I mean, people would be staring at me. I just felt every second I was there, I felt so uncomfortable, and I didn't know Hebrew. I didn't know Hebrew at all. These people spoke Yiddish as a first language. I don't even know like the alphabet in Hebrew.
But this was the only way that you get to spend time with your dad.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't go there and just kind of be, Bay Area Moshe, and it's like, oh, that's my kid. Don't worry about it.
You couldn't imagine the pressure that he felt, that I felt there. When I was a kid, the question, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
My answer was, I want to be a baseball player or a Rebbe. You know what a Rebbe is?
I do.
It's a mega rabbi.
I know, I do.
It's like, and in reality, I didn't want to be either.
Yeah.
But both were filling this supposed, this hole that I thought was in me.
Yeah.
The baseball for my manhood, the Rebbe for my spirit. And in reality, I wanted neither of those things. I wanted to be the lead white supremacist on a new TBS show. So that's sort of the beginnings.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. I started getting older, and it was coming towards the bar mitzvah age.
Yeah.
And like I said, the people that have a year-round Jewish experience, they're not like having, it's almost like the coal to diamond pressure Judaism is what I got. Regular Jews or whatever walking through the world, they just have an experiential, they have a life of Judaism and it's fun and it's not, and they're friends and they go to summer camp and they make lanyards and they stare at flat Jewish chests and, they have like a life. I was just like had this pressure, and as it was getting closer, that pressure was like getting close to breaking me, and the local rabbi, Rabbi Meisels, saw me and took pity on me. He knew, he could tell where I was. He took pity on me. He told my dad,
"Yeah,
let me have him on like Wednesday afternoons or whatever, and I'll teach him basic Hebrew."
Yeah,
and this is like the late 80s, so at that time you could ask for some alone time with a kid, and they'd be handed over, no questions asked, right? So I would go to his house, and he would teach me the alphabet. I mean, it literally, we were starting at the beginning. I mean, and this is a person who's used to, I remember that same rabbi I confided in him. I go, "I don't know that I'm going to be religious when I grow up." And he like started stammering. And he just was like, I don't know how to answer. You would think that that question would be like sort of the entry level rabbi question.
Right,
"Hey,
right,
rabbi, I don't know if I'm going to be Jewish guy."
Yeah, yeah.
He was so religious that no one had ever asked him a question like that before.
Wow.
This, they would say, "Okay, so it's on the Sabbath, you light a candle, but the sun goes down and your drapes catch on fire."
Can I turn on the oven, please?
Yes. One, he's going, "Well, you know, Rabbi Hillel said," he can answer that. Just fundamental, "Hey, should I be Jewish?" And just like, he was like, "I'm out of my depth here." He outsourced me to another rabbi. So that's the level of religiosity guy was.
And what are the other rabbi? I mean, why the other rabbi? Was he just like...
So he's from, my father married into a sect of Hasidic Judaism known as the Satmar Hasidim, who are the most hardcore of all, if you can imagine.
I honestly, the only Jew that I knew growing up was my pediatrician. Until in college was the only, there was like a Jewish kid in, when my mom remarried, we lived in another town for 2 years, and there was a Jewish kid in, one Jewish kid.
Uh-huh.
In
we call him the town
third
Jew.
Grade. No, I mean, and there were other Jews in town, but it just, that was in my third grade class. There was one Jewish kid, and all the kids would ask him about like, and it was, you know, it's the classic thing about like, "Wait, you get presents 12 days or, you know," and then he would say like, "Yeah, but one of them's a toothbrush."
Yeah, yeah. Most of them are toothbrush. Toy and seven toothbrushes.
Yeah, and socks
basically.
And things. Yeah.
But that's the experience I was having. That's what's so weird about my Jewish upbringing is truly throughout the year, I had no exposure. I was in Oakland Public Schools in the early 80s and mid 80s. And it was when Oakland Public School was like, when Oakland rather was spiking in crime and it was too short and gangster rap. And it was just like, it was the wildest thing to then get on an airplane and go to the most, it felt like pre-war Europe.
Yeah,
really it did.
Yeah.
And I would just sit there going, where am I?
Even, like I say, I wasn't that exposed to Judaism at all. And then into adulthood, getting into show business, moving to New York City, getting a lot of Jewish friends. But most of my friends, secular Jewish friends, who then would then tell me about like, "Holy shit, Judaism is fucking crazy. Like there's so many levels of it." And then I lived in Chelsea and lived around the corner from what used to be B&H Photo. And like my ex-wife, whose name was Sarah, would go in there and they would see her name. And then like all the guys behind the counter would just be like, just like look at her, like Sarah, assume she's Jewish, see that she's not wearing a wig, and then just act as if she was like a farm animal or something, you know, like just like, "Ugh, what do you want?"
Well, this is what's interesting for me about those people.
Well, I was going to. Well, I'm glad you said
I chose it on purpose because those people are not those people to me.
Yeah.
When I see someone in the airport or on Fairfax or in Manhattan, people that I'm not going to assume, but I will sort of, I don't think it'd be so weird for you. When you look at them, you probably go, you notice, you go, whoa. When I see them, and I'm talking people that are, this isn't just like an Orthodox Jew. This is an ultra, ultra Orthodox Jew living pretty much in I said in the book, it's like building a Wakanda in plain sight.
Yeah.
It's like the Hasidic world, especially the Satmar world, is like a little bubble inside of
they don't travel outside it. Yeah.
And there's a reason for that.
Popular culture, like television and movies, like they don't know.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
That they exist like that. And I'll tell you. But when I see them, I think I have kinship with them. And they would look at me with that same look of like, who the hell are you?
Yeah.
To me, I'm like, you're me, and I'm connected to you in this way that I don't even fully, even as an adult, even having written this book, I don't even fully understand. But they're my people in this very bizarre, not just on a like all everybody in my tribe is a, it's more like, no, you're like my uncle. I grew up with you in this very weird way.
Yeah.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
I will get back to the question, why did he outsource me? Because this is the answer. And this is why part of what I do in the book to try to sympathize with the community. After the war, there was a response. You can only imagine that there was multiple responses. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that response was secular Judaism. Mm-hmm. Was people, not that there weren't secular Jews before, but now it was like, okay, we're still making this, there is a God pitch. We're really doing that now.
Yeah,
like we all just burned up and had to flee from our homes. And that was the direction that my grandparents took. My father's mother and father, they were American Communist Party members, avowed secularists. They left the fold, and my father went back to it. But the religious Jews that chose to keep it, some of them decided that we will go into secular society and attempt to assimilate. And some of them said, what we're going to do is we're going to build walls around the shattered remains of what is.
Yeah.
And we've lost all hope in humanity. We've all lost all hope in society. There is no hope outside of just us.
Yeah.
So they built these walls around their communities. And so when you see someone in the streets of New York or LA, and you look and you have these feelings of like, who are these people? Why are they living so far apart? You have to understand, not you, but everyone, and even me, have to understand that you're not just interacting with that person. You're interacting with a person's interaction with the biggest trauma that has ever befelled a people, or certainly my people.
Mm-hmm.
And their response was, we build walls around what we have left and hope that we just survive. And so that's the context in which they exist. That's the context in which they're so far outside the margins of society. But some groups, like Chabad, who do a telethon, they had the exact opposite response.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, we're going to preserve what's left of us by building walls around it. They said, we're going to open up these walls and try to like join into society. And that was the rabbi that Rabbi Meisels outsourced me to.
I see.
Was one of the more user-friendly, front-facing.
Right. But still Orthodox. Still
super hardcore.
Yeah.
But they, if you can believe it, my stepmother was Satmar, which is really hardcore. My father's family comes from another sect of Hasidic Judaism called New Square, the Skver Chassids. Mm-hmm. And those Jews, they live in New Square, New York. When Hillary Clinton ran for senator, 100% I don't know if this is exactly correct, but it's close enough to correct it. 100% of citizens of New Square, New York voted for Hillary Clinton for senator. In a totally unrelated story, Bill Clinton pardoned one of their leaders in a Pell Grant scandal. Totally, totally unrelated. But the point is, that's they are hardcore. Women don't drive in New Square. Yeah. Maybe they do now, but when I grew up, women did not drive in New Square. New York. This is upstate New York, and women did not drive.
Yeah.
So that... I was from the two most hardcore sects of Hasidic Judaism that existed.
Yeah.
And then I would just go back home to Oakland and just be like this regular secular kid again.
And having friends that have had, like I was in young adulthood when I was presented with the notion of like what your dad did, like a born again Jew.
Right.
Because I would say that from where I'm from in Yorkville, Illinois, graduated from high school in 1984, the biggest sort of sociological movement that I experienced, that I was present to, was the born-again Christian.
Uh-huh.
There was, like, in our town, there was a storefront church that when I was, later grade school into junior high was a storefront. By the time I was out of high school, it was a mega church that had built this giant church out in the country and that, tons of people were coming. Kids that I went to high school with, like this, and I mean, for him, there was a kid that was Lebanese and was, so he was already very exotic for us, but Lebanese Catholic. And then he lived in our town and then he got caught up in the born again stuff. He was a huge Genesis fan.
Oh, sure. Like, you gotta be.
Yeah, a huge, but I mean, prior to that, but which we were all kind of like, Genesis? Like, everyone else is like listening to Van Halen and he's listening to Genesis. So it was already kind of weird. But like, he burned his Genesis albums.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like, literally like said,
wait, aren't
like,
they Christian?
Burned them. No, no, Genesis is.
Oh, that's Phil Collins.
Yeah, it's what Phil Collins and Peter, the guy, Salisbury Hill. Yeah, Peter Gabriel, They're art rock. They're basically sort of like popular art rock.
There is no shorter road to hell than art rock. I think we all can agree on
Tell
that.
Tell me about it. Roxy Music is right now sitting on the devil's right hand.
I was going to say, this Rabbi Meisels, I wanted to tell you this one story.
Yeah.
So he would sit me down and teach me the ABCs and I was struggling and he noticed it one day and he's like, don't worry, hold on. And he calls his son, eldest son in. He's like, Shmuley, come in. He goes, say the English alphabet. And the kid goes, oh, no. And he goes, A, B, G, D. And then the rabbi's like, see, he's stupid in English. You are stupid in Hebrew. Everybody's stupid. That was the energy.
Yeah.
That was
God bless him. That's nice.
Very nice. Willing to humiliate his eldest son to teach me to love learning. Beautiful.
Well, but anyway, so just the concept of born again Judaism was so surprising to me because like a friend of mine had a sibling that was rock and roll partier, kind of a little chemical problems, and then all of a sudden was like, I'm moving to a kibbutz, and I'm going full bore, gonna have 18 kids in 5 minutes, all this stuff. And it was and it was all kind of like I mean, the thread that ran through both strains was like crazy.
Sure.
But I did feel, and tell me if I'm correct in this, I did feel
that Judaism is less crazy than Christianity in a way. You are correct in that. Yes.
No, but just that when people were born again, it was kind of like, oh boy, it was like they got a new thing that they wouldn't shut up about.
Oh, there is.
Whereas in Judaism, I always felt like the secular Jews were like, there was a bit of, well, they're doing the thing that's actually a little better than what I do. Oh. Like there's a little bit of guilt and like, I'm not as good a Jew. They decided to be a better Jew than me. And that there was some sort of qualitative difference to the more sort of enlightened, hardcore Jewish person?
That's a really interesting question. I can answer it only in my own family, which is that, like I said, my mother left the my grandmother rather left the fold and said never again, like hardcore communist.
She meant a different thing when she said never again.
She meant it. I think she meant both in a weird way. Yeah. And she married my grandfather, who was himself a writer, a Yiddish novelist, and they were as secular as one could be while never leaving the Jewish neighborhood of the Lower East Side. If my mom, I imagine that my grandmother was deeply disappointed by my father's decision to go back.
Yeah.
And but I also understand what you're saying. I think that in a way there is something romantic about, for even to a secular Jew who might eschew all connection to religiosity, there's something romantic about, because it's so, the difference between Christianity in its current form, evangelical Christianity, and Judaism is evangelical Christianity really embraces modernity. That's really its thing. It's like, we're modern, we rock. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a double-headed guitar and we set it on fire for Christ. And Judaism, it's all on this ancient tip. It's all biblical. And so, yeah, in a weird way, I do think there's something like where you look at that and you go like, well, they're a fanatic, but they're my fanatic. Like, I like that they're carrying on this, this torch, kind of.
Do you think, because, you know, I mean, it's a cliche about the about Jewish guilt.
Yeah.
Do you think that guilt is such a component of the Jewish psyche that it's just like a new thing to feel guilty? Like, well, you know, like, I'm already not doing, I'm not a good son. I'm not a good husband. I'm not, you know, like, and look, I'm not even, you know, my sister just had 18 kids. She's a much, I'm not as good as her.
Well, I think that, I think Jewish guilt, there's guilt and then there's guilt, right? There's emotional guilt, which I think, yeah, that's just classic. And Jewish guilt is not that different from Catholic guilt and every other.
There definitely is. There are, there's guilt throughout, you
know. But we have this, I think Jews have this heavy weight of history on our shoulders that is not unique to us as a people, because other people have that, a similar weight, but it is certainly, it is certainly ever present in a Jewish, in the Jewish consciousness. It's like, so when you look at someone with the 18 kids, there's something where you go, you're righting a historic wrong. There are missing pieces. If you look backwards in Jewish history, there are holes where there should be lineages. There are ciphers where there should have been communities. There are that is ever present in a Jewish consciousness. And so I think that's part of it too. It's not the emotional guilt. It's more like, look, that's not for me, but I'm glad somebody's doing it, because those people were punched out over our history.
And
that's like, I think maybe that is why I wrote this book the way that I did, because this isn't just memoir, it's history. It's comedic history. All of these are told through through my ability as a comedy writer. But I start in the Jewish chapter, we start at Abraham and we go all the way until today.
Yeah.
And every one of these every one of these six sections gets this sort of comedic history, doing a rundown of an American or an American subculture. And then at a certain point, like, I come into that history and I tell the story of my time in that world. And I think, like, my affinity with history is because of that. I think it starts with Judaism, because that is sort of the specter behind every Jewish community is the past.
Yeah. Is there a part of you that feels that you should be more Hasidic, more fundamentalist, more?
No. And no. I think I got really lucky in that, because of the timeline of my Jewish world, my dad, and because of just who my dad was an artist. He was a beatnik painter before he became, like, he was like an abstract impressionist painter. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a mime. In fact, he was a mime of such skill that, according to family legend, Marcel Marceau, the world's only famous mime, saw my dad miming and was like, run away with me and join the silent circus. That's how good my dad could have been in another... That would have been a different subculture
I could have been
writing about. My life on the road with my deaf, by the way.
And you would be Maurice or something, you know.
Yeah. I would have a totally different identity. And I'd be wearing a striped shirt. You know I would be.
And you would not be talking. This podcast would just be me.
You would probably not have had me on your podcast. You should so get a mime performer on your podcast. You call it No Questions with Andy Richter.
He's pulling a rope right now.
Okay, this is really revelatory. So my dad, his connection to Judaism was very aesthetic. It was very much about like the clean lines of Hasidic Judaism, the black and white, the velvet yarmulkes, the kind of, he had a very visual.
He'd explain this to you after he made this deep, huge, sweeping life change.
He didn't explain it to me.
Because how old were you when this change happened?
My mother basically kidnapped us when I was 9 months old. And I went back.
Wow.
I started going back to Brooklyn when I was, I think, four, when he won visitation
this
rights.
This happened when you were a baby.
Yeah.
His life changed.
Well, this is the answer to the question you were asking earlier. It's like when you look at someone who makes a wild switch like
that,
you go, oh, are you... What's happening with you emotionally that you needed to do this?
Yes, which was a question I wanted to ask. Like, why did your dad do this?
The way that I understand it now, and there's a visual metaphor for it that's actually sort of heartbreaking. You be the judge of that. My father was, like I said, he was an abstract impressionist painter. He was a talented painter. He was really good. He went to FIT. He had a degree in art. He was talented. I have his paintings in my house. They were good. And he was a passionate artist. And when my mother left to bring me to Oakland on a summer vacation when I was 9 months old, I have the calendar. When he died, I found the calendar from when she left. And the X's were marking off when we would return. And when the X's stopped, my life in Oakland began. She said, we're going on a vacation, and just never came back. And my father, I assume, in the wake of his entire family leaving him and in the sort of vacuum that left, was like, what do I do? And that is what religion is good for.
Yeah.
Religion is great for what do I do?
Yeah,
like, if
yeah.
you don't have answers, they're like, we have all of the answers.
Sure, sure.
And they swoop right in.
Yeah.
So he became religious in that vacuum, and he took all of his paintings and painting supplies and put them in storage in Manhattan and moved to Brooklyn. And his whole life, he told us, when I retire, he never painted again. He stopped painting immediately and never painted again. And my entire life, he would tell us, his entire life rather, when I retire, I'm going to open up the storage and I'm going to get my painting materials out and I'm going to start painting again. And he died before he got enough
chance. Retire from what? What was
the post office?
Oh, wow.
He was a postal worker.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was this really, it became this sort of mythological thing, the storage unit, storage unit where all of my father's, you know, hopes and dreams and artistic life lives. And someday, like the Ark of the Covenant, it'll get opened up.
Yeah, yeah.
And he died before he could open it. And we opened it after he died. And it was just like, you know, just things, but they represented sort of everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's like, that is something that, like, if you wrote that into a story, people would be like, man, it's a bit much. You know? like, come on. You know?
100%.
You know, but because it's heartbreaking. It's so, like, there's such sadness there.
Yeah.
And I mean, and first of all, I mean, being from a parent, you know, like a child of divorce, and then ending up, you know, and being so affected by that and never wanting. You know, and then eventually getting divorced, like staying married probably far too long because
of the trauma,
because of what it did to me. And not just one, but two, you know,
right.
Like my mom got divorced twice and I saw that the damage that it wreaked and, you know, and the damage that it wreaked on me that there's still scar tissue from today, that sadness, I mean, do you think that sort of leads into the substance abuse, you know?
Oh. 1,000%.
Yeah.
Because the two subcultures that I was born into that are more, they're not really traditional subcultures, you know, deafness and sign language interpreting and Hasidic Judaism, the ones that are sort of infused into who I am from birth, those two things always made me feel other, uncomfortable, just like I didn't fit. And the obvious way we've discussed with Judaism. And then back home, in Oakland, you know, I was always an other. In Oakland, if you were a white boy, you were just automatically another. But
sure.
Then my mother would come to class and she had this funny voice and she was signing. And it was all of this stuff was like the building blocks of me feeling like I don't fit, I don't fit, I don't fit.
Yeah.
And then when I found very young drugs and alcohol, you know, because that is what this book is about. It's about finding your people, finding where you fit.
Mm-hmm.
And the first place that broken people find that they fit is at the back of the school behind the portables where the other broken toys live.
Yeah.
And I, when I found those kids and I smoked my first joint and drank my first 40, it was like immediate, like gone.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that I felt good or that I felt comfortable for the first time. It's more that comfort ceased to be a thing that I was after. It was more like I fit.
Yeah.
In, I am just here.
Yeah.
And the problem with
and
that,
also he's cool.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
The other kids, like, oh, here comes, that's the kid with the mom with the weird voice who's sign language. And, oh, wait, he's getting high and he's getting drunk. He's cool.
100%.
And holy shit, when you're young, he's cool is the best thing you can hear.
It's all that you need.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a life preserver.
Yeah.
And that's because those other people, they have their own version
sure.
of, you know, their mother might not be deaf, but they might be in, their dad might be in jail or they, you know, it's all, those are the people, the sort of broken people that found each other and made each other whole together in the back of the school. The problem, of course, is when you're 12 years old, when you start dropping acid and getting high,
sure.
you don't have any adultness to say, slow down, take it easy, go slow and let this experience develop. So by the time I was 13, I was like wildly out of control, totally. It was so I could, my brother always says, because my brother was like the good kid, he always got, I'd never,
is he older or younger?
He's older.
Older.
And he was a straight A student, but it's not like he was a square. He partied too, but he just had enough sense not to part. I mean, from the minute I
got... He had some breaks. He wasn't all gas.
Yeah, you're always getting busted. And I would say to him, you think I'm always getting busted, but if you knew how many infractions I was actually participating in, I almost never get busted.
I'm a master criminal.
In so many ways. She's missing 90% of what I'm doing. So I hit rehab for the first time because I didn't have that break at 13, like I said. And
is
then
that forced on you? Or
forced
are
on
you,
me.
You're not like, you're like, fuck you.
Yes.
And they're like, no, you go.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
And my first mental hospital when I was 14, and then in and out of rehab through 14, 15, 16. And then when I was finally almost 16 years old, I got sober. I walked into an AA meeting. It was a young people's meeting. And I was the youngest person by a decade.
And you're out of the hospital or whatever.
I'm out of the hospital, and I flunked ninth grade at that point three times.
Wow.
I was in and out of, that's not, by the way, easy to do. Yeah, but it was kind of, there were some cool parts, because like by the time you're a third ninth year ninth grader, you're starting to get a little tougher, a little bit more broad-shouldered,
Yeah, some whiskers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like you got a Camaro. But so I had this realization, like a pretty adult realization at 15, is like, oh, I see. I'm the cause. I'm the problem. Like, because my whole life up until that point was everybody else is my problem. My mom and therapists and the Oakland Public School System and Oakland Police Department, my dad and the rabbis, like every, and the people that are giving me psychological diagnoses and the people at the rehab, my rehab counselors, my family. I was in therapy, by the way, at a certain point, 8 times a week. Eight. Hard to do. That's more than once a day.
Right, right.
I had rehab 5 days a week, and then I had individual therapy, family therapy, and group therapy. And that.
Wow.
So my whole life was just being analyzed and
talking about your feelings
and how had potential, but and then to make matters worse, you know, my mother's deaf, and so 90% of the time I'd go into one of these meetings that was about me, and they wouldn't have hired an interpreter because they just didn't do that, and so they would say, "Could you interpret?" So now I'm sitting in the room with my mom, the meeting about me, interpreting to my mom the things that they're saying about me and being broken and behaviorally fucked up, and you know,
and the same for her. Like they're finding out what she's saying through you.
Me. So do like, okay, so that's a delicate dance. When you do that, you go, okay, I'm not going to be doing faithful translation here.
Of course not.
That ain't going to happen.
Of course not.
But I also can't sit down at a meeting with the Oakland Police Department or whatever and go, he's cool. Everything good.
Yeah.
Good boy.
Yeah.
Because my mom will smell a rat. So you got to give over like a percentage of the negative information.
Sure.
But shave it just enough so that she doesn't completely freak out.
Yeah.
And my biggest problem was adults. I was just like, I hated adults so much. Every adult in my life was just a person that was just telling me how to behave and telling me that if I did it this way and that I could change myself. I just hated adults with this vibration I can't even express to you.
Yeah.
And I get to AA, I go to a young people's meeting, and I go, oh my God, it's even here. It's all adults. It's just all adults. And this sort of magical thing happened in AA at that time, which was that nobody told me what to do. They all told me what they did.
Yeah.
And it broke down this barrier enough.
Had you not been to AA before?
I'd been, you know, there's just like there's guilt and there's guilt. There's going and then there's going.
I understand.
I was in NA meetings for years smoking weed in the parking lot and attempting to flirt with women. Like, yes, I was. I guess I was going to meetings, but you're technically not supposed to smoke marijuana at an NA meeting.
I think so, yeah.
That's sort of one of the tenets. Right, it must be one of the tenets.
It must be, yeah.
But at this was different. This was, I went to the meeting and I said, I need help. I raised my hand, 15 years old. And like I said, I had this kind of adult idea, which was, I think I'm the cause of all these problems. And then I went to apply the answer to that. You know, I think I'm the cause of all these problems. It's me getting high and drinking that is the cause of all these problems. There's a very obvious solution, which is stop drinking and stop getting high.
Yeah.
And then I got high the next day. And then I got scared. Because then I had the conscious realization, I am the cause of this, and it's the drinking and the drug use that's the problem. I knew that information, but I had no ability to do anything about the information.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the state that I found myself in at just 15 when I walked in to an AA meeting and said, I need help. And then I immediately, I was like, I don't think I can do this. I don't know how to stop. I'm scared. And then I got up and I walked out of the room, which is like a kind of not... I wouldn't say the best way to get help. You're just like, I need help. Right. And if anybody...
But it's a very 15-year-old
very
thing
15.
To do.
Very 15. Fuck you guys. I'm out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
But this...
I need all of you. Goodbye.
And I will see you in the hallway.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I was leaving, but somebody followed me outside. This guy Pigeon, who I'm sort of in touch with to this day. He's a chaplain somewhere in North Carolina. Speaking of the good part of religion.
Yeah, yeah.
And he put his arms around me and hugged me. And he just said, it's going to be okay. And I don't know. That's not that's sort of the most basic. It's going to be okay. I mean,
I know.
That's not like Ram Dass. We're not at Ram Dass level.
No, we're not. I'm
like,
thinking of all the times in my life when I've wanted to say or even said it's going to be okay and it being a complete fucking lie.
Or just
like, I don't fucking know, but here I'm going to say it'll be all right.
Yeah, like I said,
it'll all work out.
He was a broken toy too.
Yeah,
he's just some guy. He's not coming out. I mean, he is coming out there to help me, but he's also, that's sort of one of the odd paradoxes of AA is that you help people in order to help yourself.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that when I asked for help, that there was no possibility somebody wouldn't follow me outside because they're all in there trying to save their own skin.
Yeah.
And so he said that and it was enough. It was enough to get me to like, you know, get back in the meeting and stay. And that was the beginning of my time sober. And it stuck. Part of what I talk about in the AA chapter is my slow, very slow journey into fundamentalism. So I never had fundamentalism with Judaism. I always was able to wear it like a loose garment. I never felt guilt. I never felt like I should be more than I am. I always felt like what I have is enough. In AA, probably because I was so young and mentally undeveloped, I just jumped into it like your Lebanese friend.
You know,
I burned all my 40 ounces and like they were Genesis albums. And I, by the time I was 18, was like a firebrand fundamentalist for AA.
For soberness.
In a way that was sobriety, intense.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the start of my comedy career in a bizarre way because I got sober so young and I was articulate and funny. I started to get flown around the country to speak at AA conferences. And that was where I learned how to perform for a crowd.
Wow.
And that was truly the start of my performance career. I did theater and stuff when I was younger before my life kind of went off track. But that's the first time that I got laughs from a crowd.
Yeah.
And the journey of in the book is when I turned about 30, you know, maybe even a little later, I had been sober for a long time since I was very young. And I started to have this little niggling seed of like doubt of like, I don't know that this is the place for me anymore. And if I have had that doubt in Judaism, it could have been fine. If I'd had that doubt in AA as a person with a more developed brain when I entered, because I think most people that are in AA, they don't go into it the way I did. But the problem with fundamentalism is when you find one thing that's wrong or that you don't believe anymore, the whole thing becomes possible that it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily believe that everything in AA is bullshit, but having a doubt was the seed that eventually led me to, I wouldn't say I'm in AA anymore. I'm still sober, but I haven't been to a meeting in many, many years.
Yeah.
And part of what I discuss in here is my journey out. It's not a condemnation of 12 steps or AA, but it is a discussion of what happens to people when they get sober that young and then have to realize, you know, I'm 35 years old. Is it not possible that that was a phase in my life? Is that not a possibility?
Yeah.
AA does not encourage that sort of introspection, that specific kind of introspection.
Yeah.
And that's what I went through. And that's, so part of this is my journey into, and part of it is my exit from.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it's, I can see that it's just, it's not necessarily a repudiation of it. It's just a personal moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And in fact, in some ways, the principles that AA gave me are still really, really fundamental to the way that I live my life. Like, mm-hmm. really, I carry a lot of that that medicine with me to this day, for sure.
Yeah.
And I carry that stuff with me, and it's really important to me. But you know, the other thing that happened was, I was also 15. I mean, that's a really important part of this thing. So I was mm-hmm. so young that I didn't just want to be like a recovery guy. I wanted to like get into the world and like experience what it had for me and go find all of these other things. And when I was about, I think, 6 months sober or a year sober, I saw this like flyer on a telephone pole in Oakland that this rave called Cyberfest was happening. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want that.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
I don't know where I got this idea from, like raves are for me, because my whole time when I was drinking, getting high, was all in the service of like Too Short and gangster rap and like just being a G.
Hanging out, yeah, yeah. And
then
the corner, yeah.
This like rave thing, I'm sober now and I go, I'm going. And so I went by myself to my first rave when I was now 16 years old. And I went to this thing called Cyberfest, which was in the Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center in Oakland. And I had another transformative experience, another it's going to be okay, just completely stone sober in a warehouse in Oakland, listening to techno with people, you know, wearing Dr. Seuss hats. And I got there, and I remember I got there, and this was my mentality. I walked in, I used to wear Escape. You remember Escape by Calvin Klein?
Yeah.
Were you an Escape guy?
No.
Were you ever a cologne guy?
Like whatever my dad would give me for Christmas.
Dracar Noir.
The Vetiver de Carvin.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, classy. Dude. Well, my dad's gay, so he's, you know, he's not going to give me any fucking Dracar Noir, you know?
Yeah, Dracar Noir is for ladies, man.
Yeah,
let's just say it.
Right, exactly.
So I had this bottle of Escape that I brought with me to the first
just
rave.
In case.
Yeah, you know, you sweat, you stink. I don't know what I'm going to. I don't know what a rave is.
Yeah,
like it had this like mystic appeal to me. And I go, and I brought this bottle of Escape with me, and I had like a change of socks. And I remember I was walking in line and I looked down in my bag and there's a bottle of Escape and a sock. And I go, I start stuffing the Escape bottle into the sock because I'm making a weapon in case something goes wrong in this rave. So this is the mind that I brought with me to my first rave. I was like, oh yeah, you know, I got myself a little potpourri scented blackjack just in case I have to crack somebody.
I'll fuck you up, but you'll smell nice.
You're going to walk away bleeding, but attracting people to you. And so that was the mentality I entered with.
Yeah.
I just like this, like, oh, it was hard to be around me, I will say. I had like an accent. I had an acquired accent. Like, I'm not from the South.
Yeah.
But I definitely had a Southern. I never been to the South at that point in my life.
Yeah,
fully had a Southern accent, you know? And it would come and go depending on who I was talking to.
Right.
My brother, who'd been around me the whole time, I'd be doing it to him. Like, I'd be sitting there talking to him, like, well, David, you know, I don't know what today is. Oh, hold on a second. I got a phone call. Hello? Yeah, what's up, my man? Yeah. We're just chilling over here. Yeah, all right then, peace. And then I turn to him, he go, what the fuck just happened? Where did that come from? What Shaft arrived all of a sudden? Like, what are you doing? So that was sort of who I was when I entered.
Yeah, it's so darling. It's just like, it's so like, as a dad, it's just like, oh, honey, you just want to fit in, don't you?
Would you find it darling if your child had that affectations?
Yeah, kind of, a little bit.
I remember.
I mean, to be honest, I have a thing where I end up, but it's also like I grew up outside of Chicago, hearing Chicago TV, but surrounded by people that had either flat Midwestern or sometimes even getting down a little bit country.
Sure.
And so, like, what people sounded like was four or five different things. And I have the tendency to mimic people.
Oh, you'll go towards them.
If I'm talking to somebody from Chicago, I'll start talking like this.
100%.
You know? And it's just, and I've always had that, you know.
You know that you are, and I am too, and I know this, and I think it's a bad thing. I am a person, if I moved to London for a year, would come back like, oi, welcome, mate.
I don't know that I would come back that
you
way,
would.
But
you
I,
would
around,
come back cockney.
Around them, I might start talking a little bit. You
oh,
know?
You'd be a little bit more posh. Than
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm from the streets. Remember the,
sure,
the escape?
I
escape.
Do. Right.
Blackjack.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, I've got me bottle of mist escaping and suck.
What I love is raves. More, first and foremost, it's the power of techno and electronic dance music,
yes.
Right? But by the way, England plays.
I'm off to Yeshiva.
By the way, England plays a huge part in the story of raves. And like I said, each of these things is a history and my history.
Uh-huh.
And England had the same thing happen to it that happened to me when I walked in. When techno and house, which started in America. And
yeah, I think, in Chicago, I think.
In Chicago, house music started.
Yeah.
In Detroit, techno started.
Uh-huh.
And nobody listened to it. And the reason that house music started in America was because disco was so gay and so black that white America, like, basically, they decided that disco sucks was
they
something.
They had rallies.
They had rallies.
Which were basically, and at the time, the big one was in Chicago.
That's
Steve
right.
Dahl.
Steve Dahl.
Disco Demolition.
I go through that whole story.
And at the time, I did not realize what a racist, homophobic festival it was.
No, more racist than you think, or maybe
yeah.
You know this. People. So the idea was, as you know, you would get it was a doubleheader that night to
yeah.
the White Sox game, and you would get in free if you brought a disco album to be exploded
yes.
on site on the field
yes.
between the two games.
Yes.
But a lot of people would show up trying to get in free and they didn't have a disco album. So they were like, here's a Marvin Gaye album.
Yeah.
Here's a Stevie Wonder album. They would look at it and go, he's black, good enough, and
yeah.
toss it into the pile. So
wow.
it was so racist.
Yeah.
That was the problem that occurred, was that disco, when it was gay and black, nobody cared. But
yeah.
when ABBA hit and people started listening to it on the charts, and when it was white teen, it's a lot like the crack epidemic. When it was
yeah.
in the inner city, we don't care. When white kids started smoking
Saturday Night Live, then all of a sudden,
exactly,
yeah, it's a problem.
It's a problem. We have to do away with it. They exploded these disco records, and disco shattered into a million pieces and
mm-hmm.
was reconstituted by people in Chicago making a new form of music, taking the shards of disco and creating this thing called house. And then in Detroit, they stripped it down even further and they created this music form called techno, and nobody listened to it in America. Nobody cared, and it got exported to England, which was, you know, right in the middle of the Thatcher administration, tired of the establishment, tired of the repressive tactics of the regime. Punk rock is in the mix. It had just happened, and it had just taken England by storm, and the rave scene completely took England by storm and changed their culture completely. And then it changed all of England and flew back. So it was like it had been appropriated into Europe and then exported back into New York when
mm-hmm.
this DJ called named Frankie Bones went to New York to DJ. I went to London rather to DJ. He came back to America, started the rave scene in America, and it spread all the way across to meet me in Oakland that night in the 90s at the Oakland the Henry J. Kaiser Convention
what
Center.
What was it that spoke to you so much? Was it the dancing? Was it like, even though you're not doing ecstasy, there's something transportational about it?
Well, this is what I realize now, is I got there with the escape bottle in the sock. That's the mentality I went in. And I listened to this music. I started dancing. I'd never danced. I was like, as a white boy in an all-black school system, dancing is where you betray your whiteness
yes,
completely.
Of course.
So the way I would dance at like Oakland Public School dances is like, I would just, you could do the, I call it, I discuss in the book, the booty grab slow dance, which is just where you try to grab the butt of your partner. This is junior high and elementary school.
I understand.
We should not be doing this, but
right.
this is how they danced in the 90s. And then I got sober and I would go to these AA dances and they didn't dance like that there. And so I would just stand up on the wall and sort of clench my butt cheeks to the beat. I just wasn't a dancer.
Yeah.
And I went to this party in Oakland and I started dancing. And then these two guys, this gay couple, came up to me, and I remember that I was like, pirouetting. It was like I was having a metamorphosis.
Yeah.
In real time. And this gay couple comes up to me, and they grab me from either side. They lift me up, and they're like, "You dance beautifully." And I'm this, like, you know, thug life, escape bottle, you know, Southern accent guy, this gay couple picking me up. I'm like, "What are they doing touching all on me? You know, what do they think I am? Who do they think I am? I'll show them who I am." When they let me down, I grabbed them both and, like, kissed them both on the cheek and say, "You do too." Like, I literally became a different person.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know that when people think about raves, they think, like, they like roll their eyes and go, yeah, like, what kind of corniness are you even talking about? But I had this, like, metamorphosis. And now I understand it as, like, I had this childhood that was filled with, like I said, like, arrest and violence and divorce and resentment and cultural confusion and deafness and shame and feeling out of sorts and drug addiction and rehab. And that's what my whole childhood was.
Yeah.
My whole life, that's how I felt when I was a kid. And then I didn't get a childhood. I just got like clinicians. And then I get to the raves, scene. And, like, I don't know if you, have you been to a rave at all?
I never have. Yeah.
They have this.
Not my thing.
And I, it's not everybody's thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a thing in raves that is very infantile. Everybody's wearing bright colors. Mm-hmm. Everybody's wearing, like, especially in the 90s, like, Mickey Mouse stuff and Dr. Seuss hats.
Pacifiers.
Literal pacifiers.
Literal pacifiers, yeah.
And by the way, I had a pacifier. And the reason people have pacifiers.
No judgments.
No, well, you will after I tell you why. Because the reason people use pacifiers in raves is because when you take ecstasy, which everybody at raves does, it makes you grind your teeth.
I know.
And so they suck. So that is your secret.
Yeah, yeah.
So they suck.
And also there's a dry mouth, a component of it with the dancing. And then so it's like, right. Yeah.
So they
it's
do,
like you don't want to keep loading lozenges. So you might as well just, you know.
You might as well suck on a pacifier.
Put on a passy.
So they're on drugs. They do the pacifier to avoid grinding their teeth into little rave nubs.
Yeah.
And I'm sober. I'm in AA. I got the pacifier because I thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
I just was like, this is a good look.
Right, right, right.
It was a Tweety Bird pacifier. I remember it well. And I used to bring a stuffed monkey puppet to these raves and, like, dance around with it. Like, I had friends, my old, like, drug friends who came to me, and they were like, I remember this dude, Joey, came up to me. He's like, "Hey, man," because I had, like, you know, bleach blonde hair, and I would wear it with barrettes, and I had this, like, choker with little candy, like, neon stars on it, and I just looked like such a buffoon. And he's like, "Hey, man, people saying you gay now. You want me to go beat their ass?" And I was like, no. Like, I felt this. That was the world I came from,
yeah.
Right? And I felt this, like, freedom, like, I don't care about that at all.
Yeah.
And what I realize now is all the infantilism in the rave scene, all the, like, pacifiers and stuffed monkey puppets and barrettes and glitter, and it was like this pendulum. I went from this, like, horrifying version of a childhood all the way to this, like, weird, artificial, like, drug-addled version of a childhood.
Right, right.
But it was such a caricature of childhood, right? It's like, we're dancing, and we have puppets, even though everybody's 16, 17, 18, 20 years old. It gave me this hyperbaric, artificial childhood, renewed childhood, where I could redo childhood so that I could
have been... With literal trappings of it.
You said a caricature of it. The iconography of what it means to be a child, even though we're all adults, and everybody's hooking up, and everybody's on drugs, so it's not really childlike. But it had, for me, this healing effect of, by the time I exited the rave scene when I was like 22 or 23 or 24, I don't really remember. I was softer. I had been like softened in this way that I don't think I could have found in a different world. I think that it softened me in this really profoundly spiritual way. And I'm not exaggerating when I say, like, AA raves were as healing to me as AA was.
Yeah.
And all, it was fundamentally reconfiguring to me to be able to go to that in a really direct way, actually.
Yeah. You know, when you said that, you know, that the real transformative moment is when that couple literally embraced you and called you beautiful, when you have been through and you're in a weird subculture, you're in a weird bubble all to itself with its own rules that's kind of like separate from the rest of the world. You've done that.
Yeah.
You've already done that in a number of ways, completely against your will. And they were all hostile.
Yeah.
They all made you feel kind of shitty about yourself.
Yep.
So like here you are in one that's has all kind of the similar kind of things. You know, it's like this odd little world within the you know, existing world, except they say I'm beautiful and they accept me and they hug me, you know, and they allow me to be soft and pretty
yeah.
and childish and, you know, and needy. Yeah, of course,
that's
you know.
That's exactly, yeah. that is exactly correct. And it didn't occur to me until this conversation, telling these two stories back to back, that it was the same thing that happened to me at that first meeting. It was yeah. just somebody walked outside, somebody walked up to me and put their arms around
yeah.
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, I guess that's really, in a way, like that's all that I, little me, needed was yeah. just like somebody to like put their arms around me and say like, you're going to be okay, you're beautiful, like you're all right the way that you are.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was transformative.
That, it's such a, you know, it's such a, just to somebody to say, you're special, you're smart, you're good, I care about you, I like you. Like, that is such a powerful thing. And there's so many stories. I just watched a documentary about a cult where it seemed like, it's at HBO, it's not worth, but every person that they talked to in the thing, there was like almost everybody they interviewed had a moment where the leader of the cult said, you are so brilliant.
Mm.
And they all went like, and nobody ever told me that.
Right.
And just, it breaks your heart to think about this world where how many people are walking around having never been told you're special, you're beautiful. And so when they hear it, they go, all right, what do you want?
Anything you got, it's yours. Yeah.
It's such a beautiful thing, such a sad thing, such a dangerous thing, but also like can be such a transformative thing. Obviously, you sitting here, you know, like it made all the difference in the world to you.
Yeah.
That somebody was nice to you.
It's just what you're saying. Like the first 15 years, I mean, listen, my mother told me she loved me.
I know.
But the messaging I received was it's not going to be okay. You're not beautiful.
Yeah.
Like that was the primary message I received is you are broken. There is something wrong with you. And both of those things, both of those people hugging me, both of them were just saying like, it's okay.
Yeah.
You're okay.
Yeah.
And I just don't know that I would be around if it wasn't for those two things.
Yeah.
That messaging.
Yeah,
just what you're saying, like, and everybody needs that so badly. Like I talk to these people because you have kids. I have a kid. I tell my daughter I love her, like, I would say an obnoxious amount of times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet friends who are like, yeah, my dad never really said that. I'm like, it just feels like that's, you know, it's as sophisticated a parenting technique as you're going to be okay is an advice technique.
Yeah,
it's just I love you.
Right,
you're good.
Right,
you're
right,
special.
Right.
And yeah, I had missed that. And I got that back. I feel very lucky that I got that back.
Like, yeah.
I got that chance. Because, you know, even if my mom was saying it, I couldn't hear it because the other stuff was so loud.
Yeah.
And these strangers telling me that, like, it hit me and it resonated. And I'm also very lucky that I didn't join the cult in that HBO documentary because I probably could have. I was a prime candidate.
I don't know. No, because I think the other underpinning of it all was they were high all the time.
Yeah.
One of them even said, well, somebody had to put weed on the table. That was a line in it. Like, okay, well, I know where they're coming from.
I mean, it was, raves were not just emotionally transformative, but they were literally transformative to me. I mean, to me as well. The second party I ever went to, and this is my favorite story in the whole book, but the second party I went to that first rave and my identity changed. I bought all new clothes, barrettes, everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know how to get to another one. Cyberfest was like on telephone. It was a big party.
Yeah.
You could buy tickets at Ticketmaster. But I didn't know how to get to another one. You know, now I'm like all dressed up and nowhere to rave. You know,
yeah,
but I've literally...
And no internet.
No internet.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it was a secret society. I mean,
yeah.
It really is. And that is part of what I love about subcultures is these little crevices and alleyways into weirdo people on the outside.
And it's our thing.
It's our thing.
Yeah.
And that it's our thing is my thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
true in deafness. It's true in Judaism. It's true in Burning Man. It's true in stand-up. It's
in
true
comedy.
In
comedy. Yeah, yeah.
So I went to this AA dance, another AA dance, my last ever AA dance. Uh-huh. And this guy, who's one of my best friends to this day, he saw me dancing. Now I've learned how to dance. I'm like, you know, doing a Crystal Waters like shuffle at this like vets hall in Danville, California. And he goes, "Do you go to you go to raves?" And I go, "Well, I've been to rave. I've done one. A couple hugged me. I've had a transformative experience. Is that what you mean?"
Yeah.
He goes, "What part?"
Barrettes.
Yeah. He goes, "What party do you go to?" I go, "Cyberfest." And he's like, "Oh, let me show you a real party." And he goes, "I'm going now."
And he's sober too?
He's also sober.
Wow.
It's random. And truly, this book is about, more than anything, the random happenstance by which a life occurs.
Yeah.
That only by the time you get to a phase of adulthood can you look back and say, oh, this was a journey. This was a path that I've been on.
Yeah.
At the time, it feels like I'm just being slapped from experience to experience. The way I started stand-up was completely random and weird. But now I look back, I go, oh, because...
It's from subculture to subculture to bubble to bubble, you know?
And experience to experience. And if you look back and you're a person who believes in magic and faith or whatever, you can say, I see now in hindsight it was destiny. Or if you're not, you go, oh, wow, look at this random pattern.
Yeah,
Neither is more magical. They're both really incredibly magical.
Right. Yeah.
And
Or you followed your nose to the aromas that you were accustomed to and that you enjoyed.
100%. And you didn't even know you were following your nose. You
just
I mean, I'm sure your life is filled with that too. Like these random pings where like, if I wasn't here, I'd be here.
Yeah,
And then there's that thing like when you're in the middle of deep pain, you say, this is awful. But then you go, you know, that story, like the Chinese story where the guy comes and the army says, we need to take all the kids to the army. And they go to the guy who's only got one son. They say, we need your son. And everybody goes, that's awful. He goes, maybe. And then they find the son, but he's injured himself. And they go, oh, that's great. He goes, maybe. And then they, you know, that's what, even in the moments of darkness, you go, this is awful. Maybe, but it might be good too.
Yeah, it might end up being good. Yeah.
So he throws me in his car. It's 10 p.m. And he says, we're going to go to a real party. And the way you would find parties at that time is you would call a voicemail. And it would just be a pickup, and there'd be this like voice on the other end, often a British accented voice, just saying like, "Come to the, here's where the map point is." It wasn't even the directions to the party; it was directions to the place where you would get directions to the party.
Clearing in the woods, or
yes,
something.
And there'd just be a man standing under a streetlight, and he'd hand you a slip of paper, and it would say, "Here's where the party is." We get the directions to the party. It's a full moon; that's significant, but I didn't know it at that point. It's like midnight almost when we get directions, and we drive an hour and a half south to Santa Cruz, California, from the Bay Area. To this place called Bonnie Doon. And I look down the beach and there's 1,000 kids down at the beach, and the full moon is in the sky. And I take off running down the beach to this party that's happening down. This is a totally different kind of party. This isn't at a convention center. It's not 10,000 people. It's like 800, 1,000 people, weirdos, you know, just like psychedelic, bizarro people. Like the music is slower and deeper than it was at that first party. And I'm down there. This is a real rave, like an underground full moon party, they called them in the Bay Area. Every full moon, they would bring stacks of speakers down to the beach in Santa Cruz or whatever beach they could find. And we get down there and I'm dancing and I sit down around this fire I could tell you the version that's in the book, but it's a little bit more narrative, I guess, which is to take an aside.
Yeah.
My name is Moshe Kasher.
Mm-hmm.
My birth name when I was born was my dad. In the Jewish religion, the father is supposed to have the right of naming the second child. Mm. The first one goes to the mother, the second one goes to the father. And my father said, I want to name him Moshe. Now my mother said, we can't name him Moshe. That's a crazy name. It sounds like moose. Now, my mother is deaf. My father is deaf. My mother has never heard the word Moshe.
Yeah.
She's never heard the word moose. She does not know what either of these things sound like.
Yeah.
And yet she won the debate, I guess. And my birth name was Mark Moshe Kasher. And my father never called me Mark. And he never acceded to that. When they left, that was the one battle he always fought. I was always Moshe. Always, always Moshe.
Were you Moshe to your mother or were you Mark?
I was Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
To my mother, I was Mark. To my father, I was Moshe. And on my birth certificate, it was Mark Moose Casher. And
Moose.
No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Mark Moose Casher.
Okay.
So I stayed Mark through my whole childhood, through all my rehab years. I was Mark. Even when in Oakland at the time in the early 90s, Mark became, I don't know if you know this, but it became a hip hop slang insult. A Mark was like a fool.
Like a sucker.
A sucker.
Yeah.
And so everybody was, you a Mark, Mark. And, and the truth is, I felt like that. Yeah. I felt like a Mark. I felt like a coward and a sucker and a person that didn't belong. And when I finally got...
Even in Brooklyn, were you Mark?
No, in Brooklyn, I was always Moshe. Yeah, always, okay. Always, my whole life. I never identified with my real name, but I didn't want to stand up in Oakland public schools and go, if you wouldn't mind calling me by my biblically mandated name. So I go to rehab. I get out of rehab. I get sober. I go to this rave. I'm in this process of transformation. I'm looking for this new identity. You know, I'm looking to recreate who I am. Now, there's a video game called, I don't know if you play video games?
No, I don't.
There's a video game called Katamari Damacy. Mm-hmm. And it's this video game where this little, anybody? Katamari Damacy? It's a classic. It's this little prince. Prince, I think his name is Katamari. And the object of the game is that you roll around a little teeny tiny ball, a little ball, and you grab everything. As you're rolling it around, you're picking up stuff, dander and threads of spools of thread, and then cups and tables and cars, and it gets bigger and bigger. That's the whole game. Mm-hmm. Bigger and bigger till finally the mission is that you make this ball so big that it becomes the moon. He throws it into the air, and Katamari has won the game when he throws the ball into the air and it becomes the moon. Now, that's sort of what my life was like,
yeah.
was like this little prince, but it was a negative ball. I was, as I pushed my little ball through the world, I was picking up all of these terrible things, a psychological diagnosis, a pair of handcuffs, an arrest record. I go to rehab, to pain, suffering. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it's dominating me. It's so huge that when I got to AA, I said to the people there, the biggest thing I needed was relief from this ball. And I said to them, like, I got this fucking ball here. I got a ball I've been pushing. And they're like, oh, the ball. We know about the ball. Stop running. And I go, you don't understand. If I stop running, it's going to run me over. They're like, don't worry about it. Just stop running. I go, really? Stop running? They're like, yeah. Stop running. So I stopped running when I got to AA.
Yeah.
And the ball teeters, groans, rolls me right the fuck over. And I it hurt. And I go, it just ran me over. And they were like, yeah, it does that.
Yeah.
And I go, you knew this was going to run me over.
Yeah.
And I go, well, what do I do? Now what do I do? You know, I puff some air into my body, all like Acme, Wile E. Coyote style, and puff some air back into my body. And I go, what do I do now? And they walk over with a tiny hammer and chisel, and they go, get to work. And so I start chiseling away the ball.
Yeah.
And that's what I had been doing up until that point. I had been chiseling away at the ball, but it still loomed large. It was still like all, it was this big ball representing every mistake I'd ever made, every wrong turn I'd ever taken.
Yeah.
Even at the raves, even after my transformation, even after those two people hugged me and told me it was going to be okay and I was beautiful, I was still dominated.
It's not over, yeah.
I was still dominated by this. And I get down to this party and the full moon's in the sky, and I sit down at this bonfire that they're having, and Jeremy's there, my friend who brought me to the party, and I'm meeting these girls, and this woman Alona is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. But everyone there, by the way, is the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. I can't even believe it. And they're going around and she's talking to me, and she says, like, well, what's your name? And I go, well, it's Moshe. It's the first time I've ever told anyone my name is Moshe.
Yeah.
And she says, well, it's nice to meet you, Moshe. And I turn and go, oh, did you meet my ball? And the ball's gone. And the full moon is shining brighter than ever before. Little Katamari had thrown some of that ball into the sky. I've never gone by another name since. I've been Moshe since then.
Yeah.
That is how I determined my name and found my identity in this new reality. And I've never really seen that fucking ball since.
That's great. That's great. That's lovely. We've been talking a long time.
I have enjoyed every second of it.
It's been fantastic.
I also went to Burning Man.
Yeah. No, I mean, we may have to do a part two at some point when you write the next book. I do, because, I do want to know, like, where you go from here. But I also want to, the one thing that I want to just ask, because you've been through so much, and especially so much so young, was that, thought of having a child daunting to you? Like, did you feel like I can do this? You know,
I know what you're saying. And I now, the thought of having a child was not daunting to me.
Yeah.
Having a child is daunting to me.
Yeah.
Because now when I see her and everything that I understand about her difficulties, any difficulties, they're all mashed through this lens. You know, I think it's a pretty story about the ball, but the truth is, and it is true, but it's also, it's not fully true ever. We are always, and I'm sure you are, we are always a product of this building blocks of trauma that are not really possible to fully excise from you.
I'm 20 times, 50 times better than I used to be. I've lived a life haunted by depression with the fucking ghost following me.
Yeah.
And I have kind of shook them mostly.
Right.
And but I still have days when I don't know what the fucking point of anything is.
Yeah, and with these ghosts that you shake, it's like then you go into this dip and you go, fucking, you're still here?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's...
Absolutely. It's, I was just talking to somebody about, like, the crux of therapy for me was, wait a minute. Everybody does all this shit, and I can't do anything about all this shit that people do. The only thing I can control is my reaction to it.
Yeah.
They don't ever fucking change. I have to adjust. I have to change. That's no fucking fair. And the answer is, yeah. Well, that's it. You know, decades of getting to the point where it's like, yeah, that is. Yeah. You know, you can't, you know, you cannot change other people. You can get away from people. That there are people that it just becomes so hopeless. You can get away from them, but you're not going to change them. But I still have days of like, what the fuck? Come on, people.
Yeah.
I got to do it all. It's all the work is on me, you know? So yeah, it never ends.
No, there's this. And you know, Natasha and I, my wife, Natasha Leggero, and I do this. We do this advice podcast, a comedy advice podcast. We'd love to have you on. And
I'm there.
And you see this, people call in and it's just like, there is no escaping it.
Mm-mm.
It is, it follows on the Endless Honeymoon podcast. It follows, you know, but you see people, it follows people. It follows everyone. You cannot escape. There is no escaping a ghost. The ghost will always be there. And when I, and to what you're saying about changing yourself, like one, I remember one of the most profound AA lessons I learned had nothing to do with AA. This like Hawaiian kahuna guy that was probably trying to hook up with me when I was underage. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Gave me this book of Hawaiian spirituality that I remember this line from it. It said, the world and its people are the cause of all of your problems. But obviously you cannot change the world and its people. Just change yourself and you will find that the world and its people have changed around you.
Yeah.
And to me, that is the process.
Yeah.
It's like you change yourself and then all of a sudden the adults become less scary. The trauma, the ghost becomes smaller, the ball becomes smaller and you can walk through the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a kid and anything that happens, any attention deficit that I notice, any behavioral blip, any of it becomes, it's your ghost. It's like my ghost pops back up and goes, you know, this is very similar to what you were going through.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what this means, mm-hmm. right? You know that it's possible that blah, blah, blah. And
also, I'm coming for her.
Yes, no, that's exactly. And I'm coming for her because you created her.
Yeah.
Because she came through you.
You brought her to this party.
Yeah. And she's built of you. And the thing that I need to remember with her is that like I said, destiny only becomes destiny when you look back, and destiny doesn't move. There is no destiny moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, she is mine, and she does belong half to me. But I also am giving her an experience that is profoundly different than the one that I have.
Yeah.
One that isn't filled with analysis and filled with labeling. And it's one that I hope, if I do this right, is like filled with love. And this book I wrote is actually dedicated to her because not only love, but I want her to have these experiences too. I want, as wild and maybe unconventional as my journey was, like, I want her to find worlds of her own. I want her to find her own people. I want her to find her own way. I don't want to let my fear of her becoming like me stand in the way of her becoming who she's supposed to be.
Yeah. Is that the main thing you want her to know, or is there something else kind of, you know, that you'd tell her?
Well, that is the main thing that this book is for mm-hmm. her. And I'm not trying to get back to plugging the book, but that the message I realized only in writing the whole book was like, I hope so desperately, because for me, this journey was so huge of like, and with comedy, like this is the one that I settled into, with comedy and with Burning Man, with all of them, I got these lessons from all of these communities that I spent my life in that have formed my personhood. They formed who I am, like really, really on this fundamental level. And so I don't know if it's the main thing I want her to know in life, but I think, yes, that if I said once to my brother, like, if I have a religion, it's have fun.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. we have a family, a Leggero Casher family motto, or a family like credo. And mm-hmm. it's work hard, try your best, believe in yourself, be kind, and have fun.
Yeah.
And I think like if you can just find the combo of all of those things,
yeah.
then you can have a good life. Because you're right, Andy, like it's not possible to, you cannot exit life without some form of ghost attaching itself to you. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. It mm-hmm. just isn't. The world is painful. The world is filled with sadness and chaos. And the only thing that, for me, that makes that chaos palatable is experiencing all of the joy and the beauty that is also a big part of life. You know, there's a Yiddish writer, Shalom Aleichem, who was a friend of my grandfather's actually, but he's a very famous Yiddish writer. And mm-hmm. he wrote a novel called Some Laughter, Some Tears. And to me, that is the encapsulation of the entirety of Jewish history in four words, yeah. Some Laughter, Some Tears. And to me, that's the entire, that could be the encapsulation of what life is. It's like some laughter, some tears. And it's so easy if you do not develop and you do not do hard work, like you said, like you have been doing, to just let it be some tears or yeah. all tears.
Yeah.
You just have to find like some laughter and yeah. find the joy. Yeah, so yeah. yes, I guess that is what I'd want to leave her
or
with.
Or some, or the, there. There are damaged people who it's just laughter.
Oh, just some laughter?
You know, yeah, you know. there are some people that like they are on the run from those tears.
Skimming
you know?
On the surface of life. And you know what? That's a good point because that's no life either.
No.
You know that, and that is what drugs are, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's filled with degradation and sadness, but really at the, when it comes down to it, what drug addiction is about I don't want to go below because what's the monster lurking below the surface of the water is too scary. So I'm going to take these drugs to try to just stay skimming
yeah.
on top.
Yeah,
neither
yeah.
of those are a life.
Yeah, it's true.
But I'm glad for the life I had and the life that I have. It's created this like really beautiful thing. And like it sent me into stand up and like, you know, what stand up is, we've been talking a long time, but what stand up is, obviously it's the creative like thing that pays my bills and makes me happy as an artist. But also like if I hadn't gone on that random trip to New York City that one summer and run into Chelsea Peretti, who I'd gone to middle school with, and she's like, I'm doing stand up now. And I went to an open mic with her and watched her do stand up and went to a good showcase that night and watched Patrice and Sarah Silverman do stand up and gone, what the fuck am I even looking at?
Yeah.
Then I never would have started stand up and I never would have met Natasha and I never would have created this person who I just literally came from her holiday pageant at her school and watching her sing a song. Like, she wouldn't exist.
Ours was last night.
Yeah, there'd yeah. be some other person and I'd be in some other life. And this is the life that I got. And I'm super grateful for it. And I'm super grateful that it led me even here.
Well, thank you. Well, the book, Subculture Vulture, A Memoir in Six Scenes, it's coming out at the end of January.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it. I told Moshe when I got here to the studio, they're like, here's some mail for you. And it was a copy of the book, like just in time for me to have like 7 minutes to read it before we did this.
You know what? I like reading a book and then watching the movie. So this will be kind of like that. You know,
yeah.
You listen to the podcast and then read the book.
Excellent.
But I'm very proud of this book. I worked super hard on it and I think it's my best work. And I hope that the people that get it enjoy it very much.
Well, I hope it does really well. And this has been a wonderful conversation and I really appreciate you coming out and doing it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy. I appreciate it too.
And thank all of you for listening. And I'll be back next week with more of The Three Questions. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The 3 Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing? Can't you feel it ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a-knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.